You know I've raved about outer before, and I love my outer sofa, outdoor dining table, and chairs. I've had them for over a year, and let me tell you, they've been through everything, from rainstorms to scorching sun, and still look brand new.
That's because Outer makes outdoor furniture that's actually designed for the outdoors. From using incredibly durable and sustainable materials to developing innovative solutions like the Outer Shell Cover, which protects my sofa and dining table against dust, debris, and dirt. No more soggy cushions or dusty tabletops. My outer setup is always clean, dry, and ready to be enjoyed anytime I want.
Head to liveouter.com/thefounderhour to see Outer's range of outdoor furniture, fire pits, and accessories. The Founder Hour listeners get an exclusive 10% off for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply.
So elevate your outdoor space with Outer. That's liveouter.com/thefounderhour.
Hey everyone, before we get into the episode, just a quick reminder, if you enjoy what you hear, please follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That way you get notified when new episodes drop. You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, at The Founder Hour. Let's get into it.
Scott McNeely, welcome to the podcast. We're excited to have you here. You know, before we get into your story and obviously your entrepreneurial journey, you've mentioned before that you were a golf major back in college more than anything else. And I know your son is a professional golfer, PGA Tour. He finished top 10 in the Players Championship this past weekend. So congrats to him and congrats to you. And just wanted to kind of talk about that for a second, because I think there are a lot of parallels with golf and business and entrepreneurship and leadership. So I'm just curious your experience with golf and how that has impacted your personal life and professional life.
Well, I started golfing because my dad, who was vice chairman at American Motors, president of AMF, ran an ad agency. He was a weekend golfer, and he worked a million hours during the week and even on Saturdays. And if I wanted to be with him, I would get up and go with him, and I'd pull his pull cart and watch him play golf. And I literally remember having to jump up to grab the handle on the pull cart to give you an idea of how old I was. And there were a couple of elevated tees that had a little creek down at the bottom. And if I could just grab his driver and top the ball about 6 feet, it would roll off the front and down into the creek. And he'd go, "Oh no, you lost my golf ball." And I would just giggle. And I just sort of fell in love with the game, losing my dad's golf balls. And it was a way to spend time with him. And so obviously when I had my family and had four boys, I hit him in the shins with a baseball bat anytime they picked up a baseball glove, and I popped all the soccer balls and said, "Boys, you're going to play hockey and golf because that's what I do."
Love it.
How did they take that?
They didn't know any better. I mean, sometimes, you know, we'd go to the driving range for brunch on the weekends, and invariably, every now and then, one of the four was, "I don't want to hit golf balls." So we'd all get out of the car and we say, "Just stay in the car. We're going to go hit golf balls," and we'd all have fun aiming at the ball picker upper, and I'd bring out food for all the boys that were hitting balls and stuff. And after a while, the fourth one would come out and start hitting balls and laugh and have a good time. I never made him do it. I just said, "Sure, stay in the car." And sometimes they'd go, "I don't want to play hockey tonight. I don't want to go out." I go, "Okay, well, just go in and tell your coach you don't want to play hockey. No problem." And they go, "Rah," and they grab their bag and go inside. I never made him do anything. So.
Yeah. But, you know, in terms of like parallels with business, do you see any? Like, you know, there's obviously the patience aspect, you know, like, I mean, just you have to have incredible patience, I feel like, to be a good golfer. But I'm just curious in your perspective.
Well, I think those two sports teach you a lot of disciplines that you need. But my dad always said, you know, show me a B student who's a really competitive athlete, and I'll take that over the A student anytime, just because of the ability to compete. And golf is an interesting sport. It's very individual. It's very, you need mental courage. It's proactive, so you have to pull the trigger. It's a round ball. It's not moving. So it's very process-oriented, very disciplined, meticulous, repetitive. You're all alone. You can't blame anybody because you're the only one hitting the ball. And everybody else is on the same golf course with the same rules, same equipment, same day. Hockey, on the other hand, is physically courageous. You got to go in the corner and get crunched by some Canadian who wants to knock your American brains out. and it is very reactive. It's a puck is not round. It bounces funny, and it's a team thing. And so you sort of have plays, but you sort of don't. You got to improvise. But you better be good in the locker room, or nobody's going to pass you the puck. So they're very, very different sports, but they teach you a lot of skills, a lot of mental and physical courage. And by the way, being a CEO of a global company, you better be in good shape or you're going to get worn out. It is a grueling, grueling thing. Sort of like anybody who's had four boys knows that raising four boys is a physical exercise. So if you're going to raise boys and run a company, you better be in pretty darn good shape. So
right.
I think sports and competitiveness and teamwork and personal responsibility are all huge traits that I look for in anybody at any level in a business situation.
Scott, you obviously, when somebody Googles you and they could obviously read a lot about you. So, we try our best to ask questions beyond a Google search. They'll see that you attended Harvard, you attended Stanford.
Don't tell anybody I attended Harvard.
You went to school back east.
Thank you. If you follow me on X, all I do is write defund Harvard about every third day.
Okay, well, maybe, Pat, we can bleep out what I just said and what the H word is an ugly word. Just kidding. But, what were you like as a younger kid, right? Like, clearly you had good grades. You clearly, were able to get into these, top institutions. But talk to us a little bit about what you were like as a child.
Well, I actually got good grades because I was scared to death of getting called on and not knowing the answer and being embarrassed. So it was a huge insecurity. Only the most secure can do nothing. And people, I couldn't hang out on a beach because if I spend all day on the beach, I say, what did I get done today? Did I move the ball forward? And that's an insecurity that I'm stuck with. And I think most of my four boys inherited. And so I actually had a teacher in my senior year who said, why did you choose to get an A and do A's amount of work and then not do it and then get a C? What are you doing? Why are you working hard? What? And just screamed at me. And I had never really thought about it. And I thought, well, mainly because I don't want to be embarrassed. And I'd already gotten into the H word by then. And
Haverford.
Yeah, right. He said, don't do it unless you want to do it. Don't do it because somebody else wants you to do it or you're worried you'll embarrass yourself. Don't live life that way. Huge breakthrough for me. And all of a sudden, I went to college and I slept in through most of my classes because they were boring. They were stupid and I didn't need to get A's and I wasn't learning stuff and I couldn't wait to get out. I worked summers for Roger Penske, starting off at $1.75 an hour, washing cars in his Southfield, Michigan Chevy dealership, working for Harold. It took me 2 weeks to understand his accent. And he thought I was the dumbest kid he'd ever seen until finally I started to understand what he was saying. And by the end of it, we were best friends. And I opened the car dealership in the morning and closed it every night. I was working 70, 80, 90 hours a week and loving it. Working in the races on the weekend, changing tires to wheels in the back of the pits, driving with all these guys. And they're all older than me. I'm a teenager. And they overfed me and overdrank me. And it was just like the most unbelievable. I just loved, loved, loved working. And if you read my high school yearbook, and it's out there, in 1972, I'm referred to Scott McNeely's shy and unassuming manner won him a wealth of friends. And most people now, those who know me well know I'm shy, but those who see me in the business contact would not say I'm shy and unassuming. Brash was kind of my middle name. And I only did that because we were a tiny company and we couldn't afford to outmarket Intel, Microsoft, IBM, HP. So I had to out soundbite them to get the people to write about us and feature us and let me get on stage and do my rant. So
it's a little bit like politics today.
Yeah. Only we didn't lie like that.
Yeah, it's a whole different problem.
And we were actually giving the customer something of value in return for taking their money. Right. And they took our money. They gave us their money voluntarily. It wasn't absconded as I mean, I don't have any choice. I don't even own my homes because if I don't pay the government, they'll take it away.
We'll talk about that in a, later down because I know there's you have a lot of thoughts.
My shy and unassuming manner, I guess, isn't always there.
Yeah. You talk about like loving to work and not really being interested in the classes you were taking. Besides sports, what were some other interests or things that fired you up that maybe you thought this could be like a good career for me down the line?
I was in the band. I was most valuable member of the band, but I sat next to this guy who played the saxophone and he made it sing and I made it honk. And that's, you know, as hard as I tried, I would love to, I still think I'm, you know, I can sing like Willie Nelson, but I can't.
Let's hear it.
And I
Let's
realized
hear it.
That. And I made a good choice washing cars. So there's not really, my dad was a businessman. I used to sit at his seat. I sit by his chair at night when he was having his cocktail and reading his briefcase. And that was back in the days. Most people don't know what BCC means. It's blind carbon copy.
Yep.
And I would read the BCC memos, the CC memos, and I would see what he wrote down. I would read what he threw away. And I just loved it. And I would go in on Saturdays when he'd work and I'd sit by him, listen to the phone calls he made. And I don't know, it was kind of weird. I just loved it. And I loved my first, I just loved everything about it. You know, the first thing I do when I got to Penske Chevrolet is I get the hand pusher out and I'd push the sweeper all across the entire multi-acre lot. And Roger would come in an hour later and never did he ever come in and find a cigarette butt. That was our game. And he'd go look around. I'd say, did you find one, Roger? And he goes, nope. And then, interesting loop on that story. I walked into the GE board as a board member many, many years later and Roger and I are on the same GE board. So it was kind of a fun circle of life there.
That's awesome. You know, growing up where you grew up, I think I saw Indiana and then Michigan and sort of that area. What was like the state of computers and technology? Was this something that you like fell into or did it come later in life?
We didn't have to. I'm an old guy. I'm 69 years old right now. We didn't have answering machines. We didn't have e-bikes. We didn't have, alarm clocks were wind up. So
you had fax.
I didn't. I didn't use it. And
but you know, somebody had it. Somebody had fax.
We had rotary phones. I remember getting our first TV, and it was round. It had no clicker, and we had a degaussing coil, and it had bunny ears on the top that you had to move around to get one of the three stations. So that's the kind of electronics that we had when I grew up. So we all had bikes. We all had Schwinn bikes. And we'd get up in the morning. This I'm giving you summer, or when we get up and ride to school and come back. Or on the summers, we'd take off on our bike with a gang of the local kids. And we go from house to house getting food or something to drink. Or we go out into the woods and heaven forbid, we played cops and robbers and army war and, you know, fake shooting at each other all day long. And, you know, as far as I know, all those kids turned out pretty good doing all that stuff. We drank out of garden hoses and all those things that you don't do now. So I really, really loved the fact that we made up our own games, our own day. We were totally self-directed. And Mom said, if you don't get home by dark, you know, your butt's in a sling. That was her comment.
Were your parents strict?
My dad worked so hard. I never really saw him hardly, except, you know, that's why I wanted to do golf. My mom tried to be strict and she said, where's my yardstick? And we always knew where it was. So we'd run and get it and break it in four pieces, throw it on the floor and run away. She'd be screaming at us. She was great. She hollered at us. She loved us. She cracked down on us when we deserved it. But, It was three boys and then 4 years later, a daughter. So while she was raising and taking care of the daughter, we were hellions. I mean, just hellions. I mean, and it was so fun. And we did things that you just shouldn't do. Nobody knows this, but we took my dad's 12 gauge and got Johnny, who lived down the street, who claimed his daddy killed Hitler. Anyhow, that's just a little lore. And we got shotgun shells from there because my dad was smart not to leave any shotgun shells in. We went out and there was this beehive about the size of five big watermelons, big hanging in the tree. And we were all, 8 to 12. And my brother put the shotgun on his chest, really, not even his shoulder. And my brother's staring down the thing. And I'm lookout. And we had the gang there. And he goes, blam, the shotgun does cartwheels over, and he does cartwheels backwards. My younger brother can't hear. He's going, what? And everybody else starts running. And then the bees come out, and it was just wild. We left the gun out there for about 2 weeks because we were so scared to go even near it. And we come back, and the gunmetal black shotgun is now a brilliant orange rust. We snuck it back into my dad's case, and in the fall when he came to go hunting, he thought, oh, I didn't oil it enough. But we told him 7 years later when the statute of limitations was up.
How much of what you were like as a kid, just kind of like free, I don't want to call it fully free, but just like, what you just described, how much of that personality and character applied to and applies to who you were like in business?
I don't know. I raised four boys, and it's hard to say how much is nature and how much is nurture. My four boys are all very different, but yet they're all very similar. I'd say they're all more similar than they are different. If they grow up with you, you can spot the differences. I think it's mostly nature. I mean, my grandfather was one of the top surgeons in the world, and an open heart surgeon. He was named Cook County Chief of Surgery. And if you go to the Northwestern Hospital on the second floor, they still have a little museum area in honor of Raymond William McNeely Senior, who was one of the great surgeons. I was jogging in Chicago early after business school, and I'm talking to a doctor, and he goes, we started talking, and I go, have you heard of my grandfather? He goes, oh yeah, there's a tool named after him that I still use in surgery. And so, and then my father was, an amazing executive.
Did you aspire to be like him when you grew up, like a head of a big company?
No, I actually saw how hard he worked, and this is a true story. So when it came time for Vinod and myself to decide who became CEO, I said, I want to be number two in the organization. I work for people really well. I take orders. I get it done. I can build teamwork with everybody. And I saw how hard my dad worked, and he didn't spend any time with his kids. And I don't want to be there. I don't want to be that responsibility. And if I'm going to be the boss, I got to outwork everybody in the company. So I don't want to do it. Vinod took over. He left after 2 years. They asked me to take over temporarily. And I said, all right, go find somebody. They found somebody. And then they had a vote of my staff. And it was 11-0. They wanted to keep me, not the new guy they were going to bring in. And so I said, let me go. And I went and I talked to my mom. And I said, what do you think I should do? She said, you just do it for a year or two. And 20 some years later, I said, I'm out of here. Yeah. That was mainly because my boys were 2, 4, 6, and 8. And I didn't want to leave my wife home alone with four boys while I'm traveling around the world and coming home exhausted. And I didn't think that it was fair for me. I wish I could have been as smart as, say, Larry Ellison and hire a Safra Katz and delegate and win America's Cups. I'm just not that good. I'm an okay CEO. I'm a good CEO. Those guys are great CEOs that are doing what they were doing. And Larry is my hero for, what he's been able to do.
Well, you were CEO for a long time, 22 years, I believe, which is a very long time for anyone to be CEO.
Pretty good so tenure.
You must have been, must have been pretty good.
And I basically, I gave them my resignation letter the day I became CEO, and they never turned it in. So finally, I just said, hey, guys, I'm out. I'll do chairman. And then Oracle came in and bought us.
Scott, I'm curious, you know, you sound like someone that had a pretty normal upbringing, and you weren't someone that, you know, was like a computer geek or anything like that. And so to have started such a formative business in the sort of tech industry in Silicon Valley and all that, I'm just curious the inception of it, right? You mentioned Vinod Khosla, who's your co-founder. When you guys came together, what was the idea? Like, what was the opportunity you saw, and why did you think, you know, this is something I want to spend my days doing?
I don't get credit for doing that. Vinod gets credit for the idea. He and I were best friends in business school, mainly because we kept running into each other at the end of the parties. And
by running in, you mean like?
We were the last two at the party. So that's what I mean.
So you guys had a good. So you guys knew how to have a good time.
Yeah. So we had fun, and anyhow, after we started
microsystems,
we started two companies. One was called the Data Dump, and it didn't do very well. And the other one was called Sun Microsystems. But it was his idea. He came from Daisy Systems, which had built engineering workstations for CAD. And he said, "Why don't we?" We met Andy Bechtolsheim. He met him. We went over to visit him at Stanford, and he had invented the Stanford University Network and Sun Workstation. We said, let's go start a company. And I said, no, I got a job. I'm making $40,000 a year. And they said, Vinod says, you can't back out on me now. And I go, all right. So I went in and quit the next day. And the three of us started. And then we got Bill Joy on board as the other co-founder. And, you know, it just took off. But it wasn't, I did manufacturing and sales. And I built the storeroom and assembled the racks, and I labeled and came up with a numbering system because I had a little manufacturing background in it.
What was the idea like day one when Vinod approached you? I mean, what was Sun Microsystems going to be?
So the Sun workstation, which Andy had invented at Stanford, was because he wanted to do computer work, but everybody had to share VAXs. VAX 10, 11s or 10s or whatever. I can't remember what they are anymore. There were mini computers. And the phrase at that time was go in at 4 a.m. and they're still slow. So microprocessors were just coming on the scene. TCP/IP was a brand new protocol. In fact, we're the first company to ever put TCP/IP on every computer we shipped. It was just in the days of the new bitmap displays. And Unix was of a big deal, and then the first open operating system. So a lot of really good things were coming together. Andy was just brilliant. I mean, most what Steve Jobs was to consumer electronics, Andy is to industrial electronics. Everything runs through some sort of Andy design, whether it's Cisco or I can't remember all the names of the companies he started, Granite and Juniper, I think it is, and Sun and all these. He's just a genius, and he put all the right things together on a single motherboard. Now, it didn't work. He had race conditions everywhere and all the rest of it because he just pushed the edges and the boundaries of everything. But anyhow, we took this board, and Vinod and I sketched out a metal box that we put it in, and we ordered all the parts, and I assembled the first 15 myself. And I didn't know what a disk drive did, or I know nothing about computers, except 10 months before I had gotten placed into a company called Onyx, and I was manufacturing manager for the first company to put Unix on a microprocessor. So I had a 10-month runway of learning, and I was actually going to the local, the mini college or the local college there, and I was taking AC/DC electricity lessons at night, trying to learn, you know, so I didn't electrocute myself and I could talk to the engineers and all the rest of it. And I've never really programmed anything except I used VI for those people in the Unix world to create our bill of materials. And our first ERP was basically a word editor that I used.
So Scott, what I'm wondering is, you know, you're obviously, you know, you're friends with Vinod. He approaches you with this idea. It sounds like you know some stuff, but not like enough as much as Vinod or Andy to, you know, make. I mean, like, it just sounds like you weren't in a place that you knew what they were building. Is that fair to say? I mean, did you know?
No, I knew. I mean, PCs were a thing. So yeah. This was a PC for engineers. I get that. And it was way more powerful, way more expensive. I just grew up in the car business. Right. And I remember the cars were selling for $7,000, $8,000, and you had to put all this money in. And I asked them, what does this little pizza box sell for? And they go, $20,000. I go, what are the bills of materials cost? They go, about $2,500. I said, that's stealing. That's like, I knew
your business
there was
brain.
Money there to be made. And so that got me excited. And so I quit my nice job at Onyx. And
did you think it was going to be a successful product?
Well, we found out pretty quickly that as soon as they found out that we had Bill Joy and Andy, we had professors from around the world calling us saying, can you send me three? How much are they? Okay, I'll take two. And we were just like booking orders over the phone without any outbound whatever. Now, we knew when we put this together, Andy wanted to do the company because he couldn't make them himself fast enough in his dorm room. And when I came over saying, hey, I'm building 200 Onyx boxes a month, he said, all right, I'm in. You know, and Benoit had been at an engineering workstation company. So it was all sort of magical. And then we got Bill Joy on, who's the Unix guru of all time. And, you know, it just took off from there. We were founded in February 24th, 1982. And in May, we went profitable. That will never be done by a hardware company ever again.
That's insane. Yeah. And the fact that you guys all came together at this time, like all the, you know, each of you had your own really like interesting skill set to apply to this is correct. Pretty fascinating. And I always think about this era of, you know, 1982 and on, in these like early years of Silicon Valley, and you have like Apple and Microsoft and Silicon Graphics and all these like companies. And I'm just curious, you know, being there at the time, it seems like it was probably like a really fun, like competitive place to be. Was it like that? Or how did you?
I do a lot of advisory work, and I just look at these folks who are trying to be CEO in this world today, and the constraints and the rules and it's weird. It's not even like regulations. It's just the way you have to act and be and think. We had so much fun. We had beer bus. I'd stand on a chair every Friday, tell them all the great things that were going, what we're going to go do. And we had beer and people were drinking. And one of my favorite moments is we knew the guy in shipping was with the secretary in the closet. And I said, everybody, be quiet. I'm going to announce that the beer bus is closed. I'm going to turn off all the lights. And I'm going to say really loudly over the PA, the beer bus is closed. So we did it. And sure enough, about 40 seconds later, these guys come out buttoning their clothes up. And the whole place went nuts. It was like, nobody got fired. Nobody was offended. Nobody was, you know, it built. And if you talk to former Sun employees, I think you will find more than any other place, they say that was just absolute fun. We rented the Marriott Desert Springs down in Palm Springs, because this was when the company was really big. And we had 4,000 people there or something. And I, as CEO, these were all the best sales and marketing people in the company there. They're there with their spouses or significant others to have fun. So I stayed away and I would stay up in my room and let them enjoy the event. Well, I'm checking out and the lady behind the counter is going, are you Scott McNeely? I go, yeah. And her screen is flashing. I can see it flashing. She goes, don't move. And she brings her manager out, and her manager comes stomping around the corner. And she goes, are you Scott McNeely, CEO of somebody? I go, well, yes. What seems to be the problem? She says, I don't ever want you to come back to my place. You are forbidden. This company is done. I go, I'm sort of smiling. And
was it like a public enemy number one, like thing flashing on her screen?
Yeah. You see this guy. Do not let this guy check out without letting me yell at him. So I said, what was the problem? They were drunk the whole time. They were loud. They were throwing things. They threw all those neon bracelets and necklaces up in the tree so it looked like Christmas. All of the other guests were complaining that they didn't sleep. Then you had a Arabian Nights party by the pool that we set up, and it turned into a food fight. Apparently, there were about 50 Cornish game hens in air at any moment in time. And I'm trying not to laugh. And she says, but the straw that really broke the camel's back was when you pushed the live camel into the pool. And at that point, I just said, oh, I'm so sorry. And I had to just walk away. And I just said at that moment, we're going to make our numbers next year because every significant other is going to tell their mate, you're not coming home till you've made club for next year because I'm not missing it next year. And, you know, that was just the way it was. It was just a very, very different era.
Sounds like such a proud dad moment.
Oh my God. It's exactly what
this is exactly what I wanted my kids to do.
I would always tell my employees when I would do one-on-ones or radio shows or whatever, I said, listen, you're going to spend more hours here working than any other activity you do, including sleep, hobbies, family, whatever. Just add it up. If you're working 40, 50, 60 hours a week, and if you're not having fun at Sun, you're blowing your life. You're messing it up. I said, so if you're not having fun, write down the 5 reasons you're not having fun, the 5 solutions. Go sit down with your boss and say, Scott says I'm supposed to have fun. Here's my solutions to it. You got to take responsibility for having fun. And I never, I mean, we had our first April Fool's Day's pranks where they'd put somebody's car in the bottom of a shark tank because we had the Spark Station one. So we called it the Shark Station one. And they put Bill Joy's car, Ferrari, out on the pond. And they put a golf course in my office with traps and, you know, with a flag. And then they gave me a golf cart. So I'm driving a golf cart down the aisles of the cubes. And you can't turn. So I was taking cubes out. I mean, they're just like demolishing them and having a ball. And they're videotaping this. And it was always on the front page of the San Jose Mercury News. And everybody wanted to work there. We had an epic water balloon fight.
This kind of really paints a picture of, I was going to ask like what your leadership style was, but you know, it really paints a picture of what kind of culture you were building. And I feel like that's super important to note, because you obviously attracted a lot of brilliant people and had a lot of great, obviously, like inventions that were built within Sun Microsystems throughout the years, one being Java and some of these other like things. And I'm just
Solaris, yeah. NFS.
And so speaking of all these innovations that were done, I'm just curious, in the simplest way possible for those listening who might not be as technologically savvy, like just give us like a bit of a high level of like how these things play a role in our world today.
Well, Twitter is, or X is, basically almost all written in Java. Mm-hmm. The Unix, Linux operating systems, so many of the features were started by Bill Joy, who brought that to the VAX world while he was at Berkeley, and then he brought it to the microprocessor. Sun was a pioneer in RISC architectures, which is a huge architecture, and we did multi-threading, which is now kind of standard process. Very early in, or earlier, the TCP/IP protocol is still how every it's the lower level communication level for basically every computer device out there, wireless and wireline. So it's I'll be a little snarky or whatever, but we had Facebook move into our headquarters, and they kept the little emblazoned etched Sun logo there, which I think is way cooler than the Facebook logo on the Windows. And they
and definitely cooler than the Meta logo.
Yeah. So they asked Zuckerberg, so why do you leave that on there? Why don't you take that down? He goes, because I want everybody to understand what can happen when you don't pay attention. And I'm like, oh. And there's not one Sun employee who just doesn't grind. Like, what are you doing so great getting people to waste time and feel bad about being on Facebook? So,
did you just want to drive that golf cart through his office?
No, you know, he's done well. I'm a capitalist, and good for him. I just wish he hadn't spent $400 million in Georgia, but I digress. So my leadership style was very participative, not consensus. It was, let's have fun. I don't care where you come from. Some people call me and want to nail me as a frat boy, but you know, I had no lawsuits, no discrimination lawsuits. We got one about a year into it, and the department asked me to send a list of all our employees' names. 90% of them were unpronounceable to a normal person back in that day, and they just said case closed. And Sun has, they did a survey, and Sun is significantly higher than any other company in the last 20, 30 years of generating or spawning unicorn CEO, more than HP, DAC, IBM, Microsoft, Facebook, Google, any of them. So we just had a culture that scaled, and yeah, call me frat boy. I don't care. I didn't belong to a frat, but we didn't care. We brought a guy in from DAC, and he didn't like the fact that John Gilmore, who's very famous, very accomplished, he'd be another good guy for you to have on your show. Just one of my favorite humans. He would wear a skirt in to program in the back. And this guy from Dex, we would bring customers around. And I knew that when I brought a customer and there was a guy with a skirt with long hair and a scraggly beard programming, they'd look. I go, yeah, he programs the new Motorola 16-bit microprocessor. And they would go, whoa. And, you know, I mean,
so that's what they look like.
He's smart. And he wanted him to take he changed our dress code because our dress code was you must. If you didn't wear clothes, we'd send you home to get dressed and then you'd come back. But I didn't care what you just cover up a little bit. But
or a toga. I don't care.
I said, John, why are you wearing a skirt? He goes, well, it gets hot back here. Your machine's under the desk. And it just stays cooler when I'm wearing a desk. Okay, I won't ask any more questions, John. So anyhow, we brought this guy in to be president to kind of be the adult in the room. And he changed the dress code. And so a couple of weeks later, we had Halloween party and John Gilmore came in a beautiful gold lamé spaghetti strap dress, and the poor president couldn't do anything about it because it was Halloween, but he didn't last long. And then we went back to the you must dress code, it's just the way we were. And
yeah, so you're having all this fun. Why did you eventually step down in I think 2006?
Well, you know, when you get bigger and you have SOX 404 and you go to the business council, and this is legislation is on there because Enron happened, and Enron broke all kinds of rules. And so then they want to put a whole bunch more new rules in to put sand in the gears of capitalism. And I'm a young kid among all these business council senior CEOs. And I stand up and I say, guys, we can't do this. There's no reason to. He broke rules that existed. Why put new rules in that they'll break the next time? When, you know, if somebody's going to break rules, they're going to break rules. I said, and they said, Scott, sit down. This is the time to turtle. And everybody in the room said, yes, this is the time to turtle. And we ended up with SOX 404, which hasn't done anything except make the accountants and the lawyers and I don't know who else happy. But it certainly hasn't made the investor happy or made the employee happy. I went from having about five pages in my board meetings that I would bring into my board meeting to review with my board. And I tell them everything that I'm doing wrong, because that's what I did at board meetings. And I tell them, you want to fire me? No, you're doing great. Go get them. Well, I was taking in stacks that were 3-4 inches high into board meetings. And I was signing these SOX 404 documents that it would take me weeks to read. And I had to sign them, and I would go to jail if it was wrong. So I was basically trusting my guys not to set me up. And it's just, you know, life just got less fun in the pinata. And then I had four amazing boys at home and a beautiful wife who was doing her best. And I said to myself, my dad never saw anything that I did.
Yeah.
He never saw any of my sporting. He saw one hockey game only my entire life, and I hit the goalpost, and I didn't score. And I was not going to have my boys say, Dad didn't see me score, because I saw all of them.
Yeah. This might be a good time. I saw on your Twitter/X bio that you say you love taxpayers, capitalism, and personal responsibility. And I'm just curious, can you elaborate on that and what you mean?
Well, yeah. I think our government, we have a $7.4 trillion ruler, R-U-L-E-R. If they're ruling us, and they'll, everybody says, well, the next election will change that. I don't know any time a $7.4 billion behemoth has ever gotten voted out of power. So, you know, I appreciate people are taxpayers, but holy mackerel. There's something. Do you know when I was born, the federal budget was $70 billion? Crazy. It's now $7 trillion plus. And divide $7 trillion divided by 330 million.
I can't even fathom that much money. I don't.
Well, I can't imagine a trillion. I know billions, but even then I don't know billions. I'm not a billionaire, even though Google says I am, and I can't fix that.
Why would you fix it?
Because everybody wants me to donate. And they go, you cheap bastard, you didn't donate.
Too bad, whatever. I'm not a billionaire. It doesn't seem like you give a shit.
You know, what's happened in my lifetime, gas was 1909 when I was first starting to drive a car in Detroit. And with all the advances in exploration, extraction, refinement, and delivery of gas, gas should be a nickel a gallon. For those of you who don't know what a nickel is, that's 5 pennies or a very small percentage of a dollar, right? It should be a nickel. Now, why is it not a nickel? Taxes, regulation, and devaluing of the dollar through something they call inflation. I call that devaluing of the dollar and printing money so that you can wildly pad your own pocketbook, do things corruptly, buy votes, and just stay in power. That's why you print money. Because if you took $7.4 trillion divided by 330 million people, million people. I don't even know what that number is.
It's but probably something that starts with a 2, but I'm not sure what the rest of it is.
Yeah. And then you went to every citizen and said, do you feel like you're getting this amount of value from your federal government? Not counting the state and local governments. Right. And I guarantee you, even the most well-compensated non-elected official would say, I'm not getting anywhere near that value. So where's all that money going? The GAO has no idea. Two days before I read somewhere, I don't know if it's true, that we lost $1 trillion or $2 out in the Defense Department 2 days before the 9/11, and nobody talks about that. Enron, they lost like thimblefuls compared to what the U.S. government loses every day and has no idea where it is. I read the GAO didn't even know there were 115 organizations in the administration because there's. I would be doing a perp walker if I ran my books like the government runs their books. I would be in jail. I'd be guillotined. I mean, it would be the double standard, and yet they have all the power to take all of the money from. You can't do anything in life without paying the government. You can't drive a car.
Just to close the loop on that math, it's $22,121.
Yeah, ask people if they think that's what they're getting from the government.
I don't feel like I'm getting them. So, Scott, I want to take it back a little bit. So I think, you know, obviously an unbelievably impressive career. Sun Microsystems, you know, has done great things, great exit we could talk about. But I feel like there's different, you know, thoughts as to who should start a company or who should lead a company as CEO. You know, some might say, you know, you need to be an expert in that given field. You have to have kind of worked through the ranks, you know, been in different positions, kind of seen it all. And then there's the other, you know, maybe thought process and philosophy of, you know, you need to be a good leader. You need to know who are the best people in the best positions, who are the experts in that field, who can I bring onto my team and trust them to do the work. It sounds like you were kind of the latter person, but in a field that was obviously very innovative and, you know, doing things that were, again, like creating new companies, right? New companies were started off of your company's innovations. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, your leadership ability, not even just style, but, you know, how you learned, how you innovated, what kept, you know, what kept you up at night. I would really like to hear more about that.
Yeah. So there are so many different styles, and most of the really good CEOs started very young, because I think humans are most productive from puberty through 25, because that was most of our life expectancy in the biological twinkle of an eye. I mean, blink of an eye. So I think when you don't have all of the other things in your way and you can focus, I think all of the real creativity, courageousness, and energy comes from young people. And you look at Steve Jobs, you look at Michael Dell, you look at Zuckerberg, you look at the Google boys, you look at all of the folks. You know, Jeff was an old guy when he started. What was he, 30? You know, so I think youth and testosterone or estrogen or whatever it takes that you have at that age, and not as many constraints, makes you very, very more likely to be able to do that. It's true in art. It's true in athletics. It's true in math. It's true in so many different areas of creativity. Now, when you look at the different types, I'm not Steve Jobs. I'm not Elon Musk. I'm not Larry Ellison. And they aren't each other. They're all very, very different too.
Right.
And so I don't think there's any formula, and there's no single thing. I think you could ask each one what drove. I saw Elon Musk's mom, and she's amazing. And
May Musk.
Elon Musk's mom. Yeah. He was amazing. And so, you know, I think I have some good bloodlines in me that helped. I think that I have a huge amount of insecurity. I can't do nothing. Now, the good news is I think I have strong character. So if you have insecurity with strong character, it tends to do good things. Insecurity with bad characters, and you get, you know, people who break the rules or hurt people.
You know, to be someone who is in a leadership position at such a young age, like you said, in those prime years, you know, you almost have to start a business to be able to be in that position. I mean, if you want to climb the corporate ladder, forget it. You're going to be probably like in your 60s by the time.
Absolutely,
so I'm curious.
Correct.
Yeah. So I'm curious, given that, you know, today, for those who are wanting to pursue this, you know, maybe they have this leadership bug in them that they're good at it. Maybe they, you know, show signs of leadership in school or different things that they're part of, sports. What advice would you give them? You know, it's a different landscape these days, building a business, so, right?
I went to business school thinking I would learn how to be a good number two. And I took a leadership class, and the task was in groups of six or seven, somebody was given an envelope and told, make this happen inside the envelope. And then people would evaluate your leadership style after. I'll try to go through it quickly. But my leadership task was build a log cabin out of popsicle sticks. And I had 2 hours to get it done. So I went, oh my God, this is going to be ugly, isn't it? So we had to design it, and I had to send somebody out to get popsicle sticks, and somebody had to get some Elmer's glue. And we put this thing together, and it looked like a kindergarten project gone bad. And so I left the room when they were going to evaluate me, and I thought, oh, they're going to tell me I can't manage my way out of a paper bag. I came back in the room, and the guy has the notes about what they're going to tell me, and these are peers, right? And they said, Scott, you couldn't manage your way out of a paper bag. And I was crushed, and I go, I knew that. You know, tell me, what can I work on? And they go, this is ridiculous. What are you taking this class for? This is stupid. You're so automatically authoritative. You take control. You manage everything. The only thing we would suggest to you is that be careful. You have no idea how much power you wield, that you can sometimes cut somebody off too quickly and they feel bad. And I said, okay. And I walked home and I didn't talk for 2 days thinking about this. Literally, I was shocked. And the reason I went through that story is I don't think people know that they're leaders. And in fact, I learned from that story, when you want to find a leader for a particular job, bring everybody who's capable into the room, explain to them how hard it is, how responsible you're going to have to be, how risky this job is, and ask anybody who wants to do the job to please stand up. And then most of the people will stand up. And then I say, all right, you guys leave. I'm picking from the people who are smart enough to know that leadership is not something you choose to do. It's something you're chosen to do.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. So being someone that was in this position for 22 years, a lot of people would just retire. But after that, you've gone on and started multitude of other businesses. So share a little bit about what you're working on post.
Yeah, so I'm upset with government schools. And I think it's practically child abuse to leave your children with the government for 8 hours a day. And you should be reported to Child Protective Services. And that's how I feel about that. So anything we can do to open up education, self-paced, online, open-sourced, on-demand, real-time scored, custom. Common Bore is the dumbest thing we've ever done. Because you know what? We're not all the same, and we're not all the same aptitudes, and we shouldn't try to make everybody an airline pilot. So I've been working with Kariki for many, many years. My golfing son has www.birdiesforeducation.com. Every time he gets a birdie, people pledge donations. And we've gone through three phases of opening education, and I think it's been valuable. We did an open source library of open education resources. We did a authoring tool called Kariki Studio. And we just now launched this week, actually, we're launching an open API for how to create content that can be shared and federated across the board. And then we're gonna keep going. And we got a couple ideas for phase four of what we want to go do to keep making homeschooling, lifelong learning, low-cost learning, and not government screwed up learning with government sector unions running the show. So that's a big deal to me.
You know, I love that. And just to talk about that for a second, because I think it's such an important thing. Obviously, there's this whole system that's been created, our education system, that it has to be reformed, obviously, top down. It's not sustainable, you know, in my opinion, either. But I'm curious, you know, it seems like a lot of it also starts from the level of like employment and these companies and what they require and, you know, for these jobs. And I'm just curious how you see that working and, you know, people maybe not choosing to, and it sounds like you're talking about primary education more so than secondary education and higher education, right?
Well, even secondary education is tenured, it's woke, it's got its own agenda. It's not diverse. My wife went to Stanford, and she came out thinking that Stanford told her both sides of the story. And after living with me for 2 years, she got really angry. I go, what are you angry about? She goes, Stanford didn't tell both sides of this. They only told one. And it makes me mad. And, you know, they're too big to fail because they won't, because they got such huge endowments, not because they're valuable.
Yeah.
Even Colt said that Stanford, I said, you did Stanford CS in 3 years, my second son who started, our third son who started Little Horse. And I said, how was, you did it in 3 years. Was it valuable? He goes, the first year of Stanford CS is valuable. The second, third years, no, because they don't keep up. Tenured professors don't keep up with Kubernetes and Kafka and this, that, and the other thing. And all this stuff now is getting invented at Uber and Netflix and all these other, all of the great open source projects now aren't coming out of university like Berkeley Unix was. They're coming out of businesses. And so it ain't what it used to be. Yeah, I don't think they need to be overhauled. I think they just need to be shut down.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like we could have a whole podcast about that, but I'll put a pin in that. And maybe down the line sometime we could chat about it. But
I'm all in because I'd love to talk about how we're wasting the four most unbelievably productive years of a human's life, 18 to 22. And we teach them how to drink, tailgate, how to smoke dope, how to procreate, how to get penicillin at the, you know, it's just... they're not learning life. I learned more a summer washing cars than I learned in college.
Yeah, Scott, yeah. Scott, do you think that, you know, the trades or, you know, going into directly from high school or whatever that looks like in the future, that going in almost like the apprenticeship is something that makes a comeback?
Well, if I could redesign things, you know, I would make the railroad car rails wide enough so that a car could drive sideways onto a rail car. But we can't do it. It's not fixable. But if I could redo education, I would have everybody take all of the classes online, self-paced, to get to a level of degree where they have reading, writing, arithmetic, and civics, and some real, a little bit of history. And then whatever age they're done, then they can go get a job. And I wouldn't have minimum wage because their parents can and should take care of them and feed them. I mean, if there had been a high minimum wage, I probably wouldn't have been in the car wash, washing cars with Harold for Roger Penske. And what a disaster that would have been in my life, I believe. So then people can go back to college later, but you don't have to go to campus to college. And you can still tailgate every Sunday or every Saturday. Schools are nothing more than libraries with football teams attached, and now nobody goes to the library. So,
and just, if your football team sucks, you don't even go to those games.
Right. And so internships everywhere where, you know, you don't have minimum wage, you don't have all these rules and laws and all the rest of it. People would just learn and find things they like to go do. And as long as the government just doesn't pay you everything and you have to like earn something, you start to feel good about making money and you get used to getting up every day and going and getting something done. And you get kudos because people say, hey, here's some money because you did something good for me. I mean, there's nothing that will demean somebody's self-esteem more than giving them something they didn't earn. Hmm. That's just a disaster and you wonder why we have so many depressed people. I mean, that's a real big reason. People are getting money for nothing.
Yeah, no, and thank you for all the work you're doing there, because I think it's going to take people like you who have had so much success in their life to have the energy and the passion and the dedication to give to this issue that is so deep in our system. Well, but I guess
I love to see my son's raised over $1 million through his Birdies program. I've spent millions of dollars of my own nickel, and we've had tens of millions of dollars of people helping with this project. But it's far from fixed.
Outside of this, what are some other things that you're really excited about to come? You know, whether it's in the tech industry or just global business, what are some other things that you are, you know, keeping
an eye
on?
These are personal answers. My oldest son, I'm just absolutely, I'm his biggest fan. I'm so much so that he won't let me go watch. So my wife and I have to watch from home, but, you know, I get it. I caddied for him in the U.S. Open, so it's not like I didn't get a chance to be with him in some of the most special daddy moments you could ever imagine. Second son is a car nut like me, and he's managing the factory to car network for Ford, and he's just the greatest human being you could imagine. My third son started Little Horse, which is doing workflow engines, microservices-based workflow engines, which changes the way, you know, life is a workflow. Ride Little Horse is our war cry. And every company that does anything can use a workflow engine like he's done. And then my fourth son is going to be, they all claim he's going to be the richest of all of us. He's 22 and he owns about 30 houses with his partner that they're buying, fixing, and flipping. And he sort of thought, Dad, I'm making so much money, I feel bad about it. But he said, I was in the neighborhood with this dump that we bought, and everybody came over to say, we're so happy you bought it and you're fixing it up and you're making the neighborhood a better place, and God bless you. And that's all he needed to hear, was that I'm making a difference. And he just loves, I said, every time somebody buys a house, you have made somebody super happy. Every time you buy a house, you made somebody super happy because they are obviously selling it for a reason. So he's very excited about his, and I'm just loving spending time with those. I just joined Flume Ventures, and I'm an operating partner there with a former Sun guy who I've known forever, best friend, and we're having a ball. helping entrepreneurs. See, I'm not a billionaire. I wish I was, because billionaires do four things. They spend money, which redistributes money in a fair way and a voluntary way. They invest, which creates jobs and goods and services. They save their money, which lowers the cost of capital, which allows many new businesses to be and technology to be sold. And they give their money away. Mm-hmm. Those are all four things that they do that are good. I think the first three are better than giving your money away, because like I said, giving money away is sometimes just not helpful. And I don't think .orgs are run very well because they don't have stock options. So, and the fifth thing they do, which is just horrible, is they give the money to the government.
Right. Well,
is it your goal to be a billionaire still?
No, I don't. Goals only limit you. I get up every day and I try to move the ball forward with my boys, with the 30 companies I advise, with the Flume and for the Flume investors, for the Kariki effort, and most importantly, I just want to make sure I'm creating a good life for my wife, because I wouldn't have my four boys without her. I wouldn't have been able to do what I did at Sun without her. You know, I think one of the sorely lost things, I mean, we're coming up on 30 years together, and I don't think there's a happier couple on the planet than us. And, you know, I was talking to a couple of gals. This is sort of mean, but it wasn't meant to be mean. I was at a conference and there were a couple of gals there at the conference, and I was talking to one of them, and she said, I said, do you have any family? And she goes, yeah. I go, how many? She goes, three kids. I go, how old? 2, 4, and 8. And I looked at her and I said, and you're here instead of with your kids. It was like I gut punched her. She didn't get mad at me. She didn't say anything. She just was stunned and sort of walked away. And I said, I got to try this again. Another gal came up and I said, do you have any kids? And, you know, that wasn't the first question. It was, you know, we're lead into it. And I go, do you have any kids? She goes, yeah. She got a 1-year-old. And I said, can I see a picture? She showed me this cutest little baby. And we're Dallas. And she's, you know, 1,000 miles away. And I said, you're here instead of with that cute little thing? Same reaction. Nobody's asking that important question. Mm-hmm. And the family unit is so powerful. It is so important. And if you want to point to something that, you know, I think has made my four boys successful, they've had a mom at home the whole time. And, you know, I just wish more people could do that. And if we didn't have inflation, regulations, taxes, and all the craziness, people say, oh, I can't. Yeah, you can. Move to the Midwest. Don't live in San Francisco. No, you can't do that in San Francisco. You got to have $200,000-$400,000 a year jobs. Right. And what's more important? And I said to my sister, who has one kid, you know, we were talking about it, and I say, how empty would your life be now that you're 60 years old if you didn't have your daughter? And she said, I can't imagine. And, you know, I think those are the messages that we need to talk about a little bit more, other than how can I be superhero CEO?
Right.
Find a mate who will, one of them's got to stay at home and raise the kids, and the other one's got to go make the bacon. And, and then the two of you got to get along, because our boys have never really seen an argument, and they think that that's possible and expected. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I love that you mentioned that, and obviously the importance of that too. And Scott, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you and, you know, just hear all these stories, all these fun stories. And just, I feel like we could go on and probably have 10 different podcasts about 10 different topics, but maybe someday we can pick it up and do
a part two. Come to Vegas and we'll go down and have a couple of cocktails on the strip and tell stories all night long. I'd love to.
Let's do it.
Sounds great. I will give you a call next time I'm there.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Scott.
Cheers.